Welcome to the Supertone Show. The show's co-hosted by Simon Campbell.
That's me.
And myself, Susie Starlight. And today we're bringing you the show from the Red Line Studios in the glorious and beautiful Isle of Man.
Isle of Man.
Beautiful, amazing place. Great to be home. And this month's episode, we continue with the producer series. Now, even if you don't recognise this chap's name, chances are you've heard his work as a producer on many, many classic rock tracks over the years, including Mr. Fantasy, Let It Bleed, Blind Faith and Exile on Main Street. And he's one of only a handful of people, which includes George Martin and Phil Spector, who defined the sound of 60s and 70s rock and roll.
Phil who?
And he is... You've started already, man. And his name is Jimmy Miller.
Some loving, but Spencer Davis Group, produced by
Jimmy Miller.
Indeed. Now, what I've got to say about that, the first thing is this, that massive organ. That's all I can say.
You're on it today.
Well, I certainly am, because, you know, you just don't get organ sounding. That sounds like fucking John Lord. You know, it's got massive, presence, huge amounts of distortion. In fact, the whole track's distorted. I think he was really, I think there was somebody on some serious drugs when they were mastering that, because it sounds, it really is overloading everything. You can hear the tape, but it's great. And did you know that Stevie Winwood was 16 when he sang that?
No.
And played it? Yes, indeed. 16 years old.
I've just got to say, at the top of the show, that this is one of the biggest gaps in my knowledge that I've got. I didn't know about, I've never heard of Jimmy Miller.
Neither did I.
And I know this song, but I didn't know the Spencer Davis group. Mm. And it's just, this is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, of course, that was made really super famous later on, of course, by the Blues Brothers.
That's the thing, because it's like da-da-da-da-da-boom, yeah. And you just hear that kind of da-da-da-da-down.
But it's a very weak version compared with that.
Yeah, this is kind of rip-raw sexy, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and this was the first track that he actually produced, because was it Chris Blackwell, from Island Records? I think he produced it, but Jimmy was working with him, wasn't he?
Well, let's start from... I want to start from the beginning.
Okay.
Who is Jimmy Miller?
Who is he?
He was born in Brooklyn in New York. Oh. Okay, right? And his dad, he was born in 1942. And his dad was in show business and he was an entertainment booker in Las Vegas. Mm. And he's famous. His dad's name was called Bill. Very important.
Bill Miller.
Bill Miller.
The famous.
And he was the guy that his dad booked Elvis when he returned to live performing again in 69 at the International Hotel.
Right.
So when Jimmy started out, he started out as a drummer and he went on the road as a singer in 1963, 64. And he got a recording contract with Columbia.
Blimey.
And then when he went to the studio, he realised that he absolutely adored being in the studio, and mm-hmm. that's really where his calling was. So what he did is he started co-writing with another guy, and then he was getting other people to record his music. And in those days, the fledgling writers, the thing in the industry was that you independently recorded your song and then tried to lease it to major labels for distribution.
Right.
And this is when Chris...
Which, of course, Led Zeppelin did.
Yeah.
When they kicked off, because Led Zeppelin 1 was, recorded at Olympic. We're going to talk about Olympic later on.
The Mighty.
Yeah, that's right. And paid for by Jimmy Page and Peter Grant. And he went and sold it to Atlantic, didn't he? Anyway,
so this is interesting, though, because if you think about it as well, it's like a lot of the time you go, oh, I can't, I've got to get a record deal before I can get in the studio and record. And yet, actually, in the early 60s, people were actually independently recording and then trying to lease for distribution. So it's not always been that way. That's a myth. That's something that I thought that now I realise wasn't true.
Yeah. It was only the big record companies, the contracts only came later on, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Chris Blackwell was actually... he was in the States looking for music to release in the UK. And he heard a track that Miller had written called Incense by the Angelos, and he'd produced it. And so Chris Blackwell really liked that track. So he released that song of Miller's in the UK, and it went down really well, very successful. And then he got Miller in to work with Spencer Davis Group, because he was having difficulty establishing them. So he brought Miller in after finding him as a songwriter and a producer to come work with Spencer Davis Group. So that's the beginning of this story.
Blimey.
I know.
That's fantastic.
I know. It's really interesting.
Yeah. But as we find out later on, of course, he ended up being part of a club with all the greats. Andy Johns, Glyn Johns, and, there was so much of a scene.
Eddie Kramer.
We'll come on to him later on.
Yes.
But of course, the next album, or the next band he did, was Traffic, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Because carrying on from Stevie Winwood, when he left Spencer Davis Group, he formed Traffic, Jimmy Capaldi and stuff.
Yeah.
And he did...
Let's play this next track. Yeah. I love the name of this song. I've never heard the title of this track before, but I know the song again.
Okay, let's do it.
It's called Dear Mr. Fantasy.
Sing a song. 70s. Please don't be sad if it was the straight line you had. We wouldn't have known you were easy.
Fantasy by Traffic. Now that was recorded in the fall of or the winter of 1967. The summer of love had just ended.
Blimey.
And when I was doing my research about this song, they were saying that it's really important. It represented like this song was like reflected the musical climate of specifically of that time, with the mystical sweetness and druggy references capturing the psychedelic fever of the day. And I love that, the psychedelic fever.
Yeah, and you can hear it. I mean, we were just talking about the fact that there's a lot of flanging going on that vocal, or there's some really deep, but it was like it almost cancelled the vocal out at some points. And but that was left in because they recorded this live, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. The set up, it was one of the very first projects at Olympic Studios, the mighty Olympic Studios.
My favourite studio in the world.
Yes.
Sadly demised, but what?
And it's set up at the end of the room to four track. And recorded his life.
That's incredible. Well, of course, that studio was the first transistorised console in the world because Dave Sweetnam actually designed it and put it in, and eventually he marketed them as Helios. And, of course, Helios was the console that they put into the Rolling Stones Mobile, the first one, and they had one in Strawberry Studios. And the first time I went in Strawberry, they had the Helios console in there. So there you are.
So it all connects up.
Indeed.
It's magnificent. And what's that story about when they were recording this? Because
we rushed in, didn't he?
Yeah, Miller.
They looked into the control room and he wasn't there.
Yeah.
And he was haring down the room. Olympic was a big studio and he was haring down. He picks up a pair of maracas, as you do, get your maracas out, and you started, he speeded the track up double, and you can hear it at the end of that track.
Yeah, go double
and he just
time.
Went on the fly. And you can hear the excitement change. And that is what he was known for as a producer, wasn't he? He was into the performance and the excitement of creating an excitement in that performance, not just sat there sort of recording stuff. He was, of course, he was a drummer and a good musician.
So what I've been interested in is trying to get a sense of this man. If I met him, what it'd be like to be in the studio with him, what he was like as a producer, what he was like to work with. And that Phil Brown, one of the engineers, said that he was like a vibe merchant, had incredible energy and drive. He said he made the session feel like you really wanted to be there, you really want to make this work. And I think even Eddie Kramer... Now, funny enough, Eddie Kramer said that Jimmy Miller was his mentor.
Well, that's incredible, because Eddie Kramer is considered a god.
Yeah.
Because Andy Johns, of course, Glenn's brother, and we are going to be doing a program with him later on. Oh, where did that come from?
It's okay, carry on.
Yeah, of course, yeah, a bit of a ping there.
Yeah, but I feel like there was like a fairy dust.
Almost
touch.
A fairy dust, yeah. Yeah.
The chocolate biscuits have arrived.
But Andy said that he learned everything from Eddie Kramer, of course. Eddie Kramer went on to be Hendrix's right-hand man and was, you know, massively influential.
Yeah.
So he learned, and I didn't realise that he heard, learned everything then from Jimmy Miller.
Eddie was saying that he had just the most amazing ability to take a group of musicians, rehearse them, get them in the studio, get them so excited about that what they were doing, and make it all seem so much fun. And that's when he realised that this is the way to record music.
Well, this is one of his recordings, and I believe this is the 82nd take.
For the gods they made.
Sympathy for the Devil by, of course, the mighty Rolling Stones, with, in actual fact, Keith Richard playing bass on that.
No way.
Oh, yes.
What's he doing with a bass?
Well, it was actually pretty good. It's a good line. If you can hear him picking it as well. But, yeah, and there's a great picture of them in the studio because they do that all together. And when I referred to 82 takes, I believe it was 82 takes that they took on that. Can you imagine how much tape it took? Holy shit. Anyway, 82 takes and...
That's commitment.
It sure is. But they're all recording it together. And there's a picture of Jagger on one side of the screen and the other people ran the... I can't remember who actually sang the backing vocals on that, but some very esteemed... people, backing singers and stuff, and then there's Bill Wyman with maracas, and then there's Charlie Watts, of course, on the kit, and Richards is playing bass.
I didn't notice that when I saw that footage.
Incredible. It's very true, yeah.
So that was released, was it 1968? And I believe that that was the first album that Miller produced with the Rolling Stones, and he's quoted as saying that when Mick Jagger rang him up and asked him to produce the album or to work with him on the next album, he said he glided over to his house on a cloud. He was so... That's very poetic, isn't it?
Very nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great, what you got?
So I think what happened was that Glyn Johns told Mick to go and check out Jimmy when he was working with Traffic, and that's how they... And so he dropped into the studio, and that's how he got to see him work, and that's why they decided or asked him to work with him. But the Stones apparently were like hired. He never knew if he was working from one album to the next. It was on an album by album basis.
So, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was.
But I mean, they've always been particularly difficult, the Stones, haven't they? I think, you know, to work with because Glyn Johns worked with them for a bit, didn't he? And he sort of fell out of love with them, I think.
Do you know what was interesting, though? You know, when you think about these wonderful artists, you know, and sometimes their reputation is formed. Solidified more so later on as the years go by, so the longer you last. It's true, though, isn't it? Because at the time...
And they've lasted a long time,
I know,
boys.
But it's the longevity factor here. Because what surprised me was when I read about that they did an album in 67, their Satanic Majesty's Request, and it was their dabbling in psychedelia, and they tried to rival Sgt. Pepper's. And also they were sort of going on that fashion thing for the San Francisco band. So, and you can't quite imagine a band of that calibre that they're portrayed as today as we understand them and feel and love them, that they would do something like that.
You mean like the Beatles did with Pet Sounds? There we are. Boom.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're all fucking doing it, you know?
See, and this is the point. It's like, this is
the
not...
The Beatles were massive plagiarists. You listen, I think we talked about this in the George Martin one, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
But massive plagiarists, you know? But they were just incredible songwriters, but the styles and what they actually did was very much nicked off a lot of other people, you know?
I mean, and also you've got what's with his unique style, which will always give a certain, you know, uniqueness to their groove. Anyway, Rich is with his groovy groove. I mean, the groovest of grooves. So there's a musicianship there as well. But it just fascinates me that people are swayed by the, you know, because really, when you connect in and when you an album and a group or an artist connects in, big style, it's of the time, isn't it? It's music of the time connecting in with people
very
at
much
that
so.
Time.
And actually, looking at the backing vocals here, because I've just a quick looked it up on Wikipedia, and it was Anita Pallenberg,
of course,
and Marianne Faithfull,
the girlfriends.
That's right,
Power.
Yeah, that's right.
And, woman power.
And Bill Wyman on backing vocals, Charlie Watts, and Brian Jones. And Brian Jones didn't actually play guitar on there because I think it was that point where he was virtually at the end of his tenure with the Stones because he was so fucked up, you know?
Yeah, they did say that. I did read about that it was making of this album, he was in and out. It's a real shame because he was such a musical genius as well.
Well, he was. I mean, he was a great guitar player and he was very much the Stones, you know, when it all kicked off. But, of course, you know, he moved on to other people. And most importantly, because I think with his work with Steve Winwood, he went on and obviously he got the call straight away for this band.
Come
Can't Find My Way Home by Blind Faith, released in 1969.
Yes, to a considerable controversy. Or controversy.
Why is that?
It was the album cover. Because it had a pubescent, half-naked girl, topless, on the front cover. And it was released in America with a different cover. But it was really, really caused a load of shit.
Really?
Yeah. And, of course, this was one of the first real supergroups.
Yeah.
Because Ginger Baker playing percussion, and I've got to say on that, it's really cool. It's a great, great part, you know. And it was Rick Gretsch out of Family.
Yeah.
Of course, Eric Clapton.
Eric,
our friend.
And Stevie Winwood.
Yeah. So it was like Winwood wrote that.
Yeah. So I think that's fantastic. And they were saying about, when we were talking about Jimmy Miller's influence, they were saying that he suggested that they change the electric guitar to record with an acoustic, which changed the song up.
Blasphemy.
I know.
Who was playing acoustic? Was it Eric?
I don't know. I just know that he's infamous or famous for that track. Miller's influence on that was to change up the guitar.
Well, I mean, I think when you're working with that level of musicianship, you know, to actually even suggest that gives a sort of swagger and confidence and enthusiasm for people to take it up, you know, because can you imagine walking into the studio with those boys,
yeah.
You know what I mean, Ginger Baker just out of Cream, and then you've had Traffic and Spencer Davis Group and Family were massive, and going, well, actually, we think your electric guitar, Eric, is shit here because, you know, just because Eric Clapton is God, we want to put an acoustic on instead.
Yeah.
Can you imagine doing that?
Yeah.
You can?
No.
And after the blood is wiped off the control room floor. Yeah, but, I mean, it's an incredible thing to be able to do that. And such, you know, such confidence.
I think what strikes me is as we do these producer series and as we get to get a sense more of the people and the relationships behind the music, they're all just friends, aren't they? I mean, this is cross-pollination of musical genius.
Yeah.
And they're all hanging out. There's a scene. They're all hanging out. They all know each other. And they're not afraid to play in different bands and just experiment. I mean, this was was one band. They did one album. And I'd never heard of the actual name of the group, Blind Faith. There are whole bands of it. And it's great to know.
Well, our favourite version, of course, is the one off
EC Was Here
with Yvonne Elliman singing.
Yeah.
Which is great. And Stevie Wonder's not on that, but that's a great version. You know, we love that.
I love that version.
With Radel on bass.
But there was... Oh, don't mention Carl Radel. Love Carl.
Well, we're going to mention Radel in a minute.
But what happened with this band, which I find very interesting as well in terms of managing expectations, really important because they dissolved after the tour in America to support this album. Something to do with they didn't survive audience expectations. I don't know what they were expecting because it was such a mighty supergroup. I don't know.
Yeah.
But well done, guys. Brilliant.
Probably ego, probably a lot of drugs involved, probably, you know, I mean, you don't know.
You just don't know, do you?
Yeah, indeed not. But, of course, the next track is something, and it's all about one instrument, and we'll come on to that in a minute.
Drink it off my mind.
honky-tonk woman. Rolling Stones. What was the instrument that you're talking about by chance?
Well, it's, of course, the cowbell, which brings me, because we were doing a session a few weeks ago in the studio, and I was fooling around, and they were playing. They were starting to play Don't Fear the Reaper. And they're actually like a jazz band. They're great musicians and stuff, and they were just messing around, you don't fear. Well, I got up and I started hitting this fucking cowbell. Well, it brought it all back, of course, from the Saturday Night Live show.
Yeah.
And I can just imagine here Jimmy coming out of the control room as the Bruce Dickinson character in that sketch. And he says, "Easy, guys, I put my pants on just like the rest of you, one leg at a time, except once my pants are on, I make gold records." All right, here we go. Don't Fear the Reaper, but I just need more cowbell. I've got a fever. I need more cowbell. It's a killer. And that's, I don't know if you ever watched that sketch.
But I have.
It, yeah.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
It's for any muse out there, you'll see it, but it's fantastic. But that is exactly what I thought. But I mean, what a magnificent song. And it's a great track. It's captured the kick drum. I think this one actually has been remastered, so I think they've actually fettled with the compression quite a bit, and it sounds quite a bit bigger than the original. But it's the same mix, and, you know, the kick drum was really, you know, really loud. And when the bass comes in, it's fantastic.
Well, we were just saying, doesn't actually, the bass doesn't come in for ages. It's just that really great pattern on the cowbell for the rhythm, doesn't it? And then, boom, I'm singing. That'd be easy to play, actually. Nice, nice, just to be able to focus on the feel of it. That's a feel track.
Well, before, of course, when I started playing guitar originally, I was learning off the vinyl and off by slowing them down on the two-track tape machine that we had at home, which is, of course, what you had to do then before YouTube, etc. And I remember trying to work that out right, and I could never get it sounding right until, of course, you open-tune the guitar to G. And as soon as you open-tune the guitar to G, everything that Keith Richard does comes instantly accessible and sounds absolutely right. But of course, unless you're Keith Richard, you can't actually play the fucking rhythm guitar exactly like that, because he's a god of rhythm guitar. You know, his timing is incredible, you know, and his patterns and what he does. But that open G thing, so for any guitar players, I am, you know, I'm heartily recommending the open G for anything in the Rolling Stones.
I've got to say as well, we watched a documentary on Keith the other night, and I'm starting to really appreciate more his grooviness that I didn't really get him as much as I get him now in terms of his groove.
Yeah.
He's groovy.
Well, he is groovy.
Well, you just get put off by everything else, because it's like, you know, they're a big in-your-face band.
Well, I actually think the only other person that can play rock and roll rhythm guitar, right, and this is a controversial statement, I'm sure we're going to get a lot of emails about this, as we usually do when I say something, and that is...
What?
Yeah, and that is, of course, Ronnie Wood. Because Ronnie Wood, who was in the Faces, of course, now in the Rolling Stones, they're both monster rhythm guitar players. You listen to that Faces stuff and it's fucking unbelievable. You know, you know, and everything's sloppy. They're all pissed, but he nails it. You know, he nails the groove and it fits together like it's a loose collection of musicians playing loosely but brilliantly together, you know. And I always think that with the Stones as well. It's never quite tight, you know, it's slack
around
the gusset. But
it's... Pardon?
I knew that'd get you. A bit slack around the gusset.
But you know, when they were talking about Jimmy being a vibe merchant, a producer, you know, who's on the feel, and the music of this time is very much a feel, you know, because I hear so many musicians who play technically brilliantly, but there's something cold at the end of their fingers. They're not... It's not an extension of something. It's just an exercise. It's there, but there's something that happens. It's like a magic, like a mojo thing that gets you going, you know, and makes you want to scream, "Come on!" You know, and that feel. And that's something that I think that they managed to capture on these recordings. And well, I really like that.
Absolutely.
But I love it, actually, just like it.
But I think, you know, any band recording together in the studio, the beauty of it is they're all listening to each other. And any great band that you listen to, a great performance, you can hear them listening to each other.
Yeah.
They leave space, they know what everybody else is doing, the dynamics, they don't, you know, they'll back off, they'll play louder in exactly the right place, and that's what makes a great band.
And the fact that they just did it again and played again and again together to groove in to get the take, even if it took 80 takes, they would do it. And so you get the collective feel and the groove of the band together. None of this digital manipulation and...
pissing about.
Yeah.
Record the whole fucking thing together. Record the mistakes.
Yeah.
And if you can't play it all together, go away and practice until you can play.
And the thing is now is that you don't have to use tape. You know, that you can do another take and it's not going to cost you like a load of money like it used to do in those days where you had to just go, you know, and go through reels of tape to get that. You had to have a big deal, I guess, to be able to afford to do that kind
Indeed.
Of a number of takes. But today there's no reason why you can't do it.
Absolutely
you just
not.
Keep going and going and find that sweet spot. And I think you get so much more out of it as a band. You bond together more, don't you, as well?
Totally.
I feel that when we've...
Certainly.
When we've...
You know, I mean, solos and stuff and vocals, I mean, you know, historically have always been put on later, unless you're talking really early recordings, you know. Except Synth of the Devil, of course, is all done at the same time. But but I really think that your rhythm instruments, and you know, really should be put together with a great old, guide vocal.
Indeed, and also...
Which can keep, of course, if it's that good.
I just want to ask you a question about this producer thing because, again, he's known, Jimmy Miller is known as, he wasn't a hands-on producer.
He sounds like a plumber, doesn't he? He doesn't sound like Glyn Johns he sounds like he's going to come and fix your boiler. Jimmy, is that Jimmy? Yeah, I've got a bit of a problem with boiler.
Well, the only Miller I knew was Windy Miller from Trempton before. So, I mean, I've got to really, like, make myself not say Windy Miller.
Okay, well, it's definitely Jimmy.
Jimmy wasn't actually concerned. He was... You know, you talk about producers that are musicians and producers that aren't. Well, he was a musician. And also, he wasn't on the board. He was there musically inspired and
like
with the
Tom
guys.
Like Tom Dowd.
Exactly. Tom Dowd. Mm. So, that you know, and there's that thing. It's like, can you be a producer and not be a musician?
Well, you see, Glyn Johns wasn't. And I don't think Andy Johns was either. So it's like, I think they played, but they weren't
but
like professional musicians.
They played
musicians
something.
Before.
They did. They weren't professional, but they did play.
Yeah.
They were musically... It wasn't maybe their primary skill, but they had a musical understanding. But what happens if you can't play anything?
I honestly don't know.
Because I know some people who produce who aren't at all musically.
Yeah.
They love music, but they can't play anything.
And they're very good producers.
Yeah.
But it's
weird,
odd.
Isn't it?
But I think the people that we really associate with, like George Martin and Daniel Lanois, you know, those are people who actually really could... play and orchestrate and write stuff, you know.
So to get a sense of Jimmy then, so he's this exuberant guy that gets in there, gets things happening, gets involved when things need judging up. And do you know what they said? Eddie Kramer said, when you work with the Rolling Stones, it's like herding a bag of cats.
Mm.
So he's had the personality to get to bring all these vibrant personalities together, get them disciplined, get them inspired. So, I mean, that's a complete and utter talent in itself when you've got such high energy.
Well, that's why Glyn Johns fell out with... I mean, he fell out with Eric Clapton, Glyn Johns, he fell out with the Stones, I think, because of this.
Yeah.
You know, he said he wouldn't come and engineer a rehearsal. He wanted to engineer a recording session. Mm. And you know, he was very fierce, wasn't he? He didn't drink. He didn't like anybody drinking or doing drugs.
I'd have been a bit scared of him, actually.
Well, I know, it's a bit scary. But he's still around, of course, you know. I made the mistake. I think he was dead a few years ago, if you remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we rectified that.
We did,
away.
Fortunately, yeah, yeah. And but he's alive.
And just in terms of the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards said that him and Mick, are two different personalities. So Mick Jagger needs to know what he's doing tomorrow, whereas Keith will just roll out of bed and see what's happening. Mm. So he said that Mick Jagger was the rock and he's the roll.
Well, there we are. And talking of rock and roll, let's listen to a bit of rock and roll.
About 6 months. the turnpike all day long. Nobody seemed to notice. They just passed me on by. To keep from going crazy, I gotta sing the song. Got a whole lot of loving, and maybe that's why I'm coming home to your love.
By Delaney and Bonnie. They're not going down very well. I think, you know, I mean, the whole thing about that is that you listen to that applause at the end, and Eric Clapton took him on the road because he actually preferred the Delaney and Bonnie stuff to Blind Faith, because I think they were supporting Blind Faith in the States.
Yeah.
And you heard it, they went down there. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it was a massive amount of bloody racket. Of course, you know, Eric was playing with him, and Eric, you know, was a mega, mega star then.
Mm.
But, you know, they certainly had something. And the interesting thing about, I'm sorry for just to say, but the interesting thing about that track is that that was actually engineered by Glyn Johns and Andy Johns, the brothers, and then produced by Jimmy Miller. I mean, these are absolutely fucking legends of production and engineering, you know? And they're actually there, involved with all this stuff. But it was like a club. There was a scene going on. And what I love about it is the scene was there and there wasn't any competition. You know, nowadays, the competition is horrible, I think. You know, there's a lot of backbiting, there's a lot of stuff.
A nest of vipers.
A nest of vipers, which, you know, I hate nests of vipers. I'm interested in people working together, always have been. You know, and wherever we're working, if you get other engineers coming to the studio, it's fantastic, you know. Let them have a go, you know, get hold of the desk, see if we can fucking learn something together.
Well, it's not a competition. It's supposed to be we're all alive on the planet for 80 years at the same time. If we meet, it's like, let's get on and make something beautiful.
Yeah. And, if you're in the studio and all of a sudden Glyn Johns walks in, what are you going to do? Are you going to say, I'm sorry, Glyn, this is my session? You're going to say, oh, come in. Now, just talk to me a little bit about that mic technique. You know, what would you do with this? And, you know, and the time he knew it, he'd be engineering the fucking session. For me, I'd be watching him. But but that is what it's all about. It's a matter of learning and not being arrogant. And I think that has changed quite a lot now.
Yeah.
And it's horrible
out there
sometimes.
Well, it's all fear-based. I've got a theory about that. I just think people are frightened. There's no need, you know. Because it's unnecessary.
Totally.
It's been propagated that you have to be, and it's all like, let's close down and, like, protect everything. And no, open up.
Yeah.
Open up. And,
totally.
And because you learn from each other. These guys opened up and they learned from each other. Everyone got together. Everyone was, like, playing with each other.
Larry was playing with everybody then because he started with the Allmans and stuff, you know, when he was starting to work with Tom Dowd. And everybody was working together. And and they created some great organic music, you know. But what I do like about these things is that they were it was done quickly. It wasn't any fucking about. They'd write songs, go in the studio, live, they do it quickly, they get it on tour and that's it. None of this tooling around for probably 6 months mixing it or editing fucking vocals, you know. If the vocals, you know, because that was live and it was out of tune, you're screwed, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely screwed. And that was recorded at the Fairfield Halls in Croydon, believe it or not, where I actually helped to do an installation there with Wigwam Acoustics. Yeah, a sound installation. But that's
a bit of trivia. That's great trivia, isn't that?
Yeah, a bit of trivia. But that was done at the end. And at the end, I think, we just cut it off then, but the bloke, the guy who's comparing, he says, yes, it's one of the best bands I think we've had in Croydon for some time. So it clapped and I was like, of course, they didn't sound like that because they were posh fucking Southerners.
Sounds like the Wheel Tappers of Shunter's Club, doesn't it? Yeah, that kind of thing. Right. I love that, though. That's real personality, real people being real about stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, but this whole production thing has turned into a crazy thing. The producers are now the stars as opposed to the producers actually... acting as a catalyst with the band to get the band to play better and then at certain times introducing elements or saying, do you think this is a good idea or whatever, you know? Lanwar does it a lot, you know, even with U2 and all the stuff he's done, like Lanwar will introduce elements, he'll say, oh, what about this bit of guitar, and he'll play a guitar on it, which is, again, a brave thing to do, but what he's doing is contributing and adding to the process.
I think with Jimmy as well, especially with this, when he's looking at his relationship with the Stones, you know, it's like he was very musically involved with them, wasn't he?
Well, he played drums on a few of the tracks.
I know.
And I can't remember which one it was now, but he actually played drums because Charlie Watts couldn't get the groove.
That's right. He jumped on the kit.
Yeah.
And they do say, Eddie Kramer said that Jimmy was a catalyst in the studio.
Yeah.
See, when you said that, I hadn't told you that bit. So that's interesting that you say that. And that's really what the role of a producer is to excite the band, isn't it? Get the best out of the band.
Well,
to maximise the room and the vision.
Exactly. Maximise the room. That's another Lanwar thing,
exactly,
isn't
he? Exactly, I always
remember
that.
He uses who's in the room, you know? And I think Jimmy Miller sounds very the same. And, of course, who is in the room? At the moment, we've got Mark Cleater in the room at the moment, which is...
Redline Studios.
And he's been very quiet. But in a couple of weeks, I think we've got a couple of months, perhaps, or weeks, I don't know. We'll probably get him to do one of these podcasts.
I think we should get in front of a mic and ask him loads of questions and find out more.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. You can talk about his Black Riders episode and all those things he's done.
His influences.
Yeah, the things he's doing now. Because,
yeah.
We've got because we're actually recording this through the only Trident 80... B studio on the Isle of Man. Well, it's the only Trident on the Isle of Man. In fact, it's the best desk on the Isle of Man by a country mile, I think. And it sounds wonderful.
And it feels like home.
It does feel like home, yeah. Trident feels like home.
Yeah.
Anyway, talking of home, you know, let's have a bit of coffee with a little bit of brown sugar. Sugar by the Mighty Stones. Unbe-fucking-leavable.
Sticky Fingers.
Yeah.
Great name.
Great name. Great song. Again, Richards, really one of his absolute classic. You know, it's very difficult to play that song. Even when you're playing it in G, and people, you know, the open G and stuff, people go, oh, yeah, well, it's easy and all that, but it's not. Because I've never heard a band, because it's Charlie Watts, it's the whole thing. Because Watts plays very awkward. When you've seen him playing, he looks like he doesn't really know what he's doing. Of course he does. But and this whole open tuning thing where you're just sticking a couple of fingers on here and there, and Wyman's got his bass, he's like sticking up his nose somewhere. It's like an erect position on his body, you know. But it just works. it just works, you know. It's just a great sounding track, and the amps that we're using. I can't remember. I think he was using an Ampeg VT100, I think, on this, something like that. The what was it? The combo VT22. I can't remember now. And those are a clean amp, you know, and yeah. they're fiendishly loud, extremely clean, but it just sounds right, you know. It's just a great sounding.
Well, they're saying in terms that might have helped the sound as well. They actually left Olympic to record this, and they recorded using the Mobile Stones mobile recording truck at Jagger's house, which was called Stargroves.
Not Highgrove.
No, I just think Stargroves.
Stargrove.
How
well,
funny is that?
That's Starlight, Stargroves, Highgrove.
It's a bit weird.
Prince Charles, nothing to them. No, but yeah.
That yeah.
And of course, the Rolling Stones truck. I always want to say the Rolling Truck Stones thing, because that's a Smoke on the Water, of course, which they recorded a Machine Head with in Montreux. That also had a Dave Sweetnam console, and that also had a Helios console.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that very console, of course,
of
recorded...
course. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. When the Levee Breaks, one of Mark's favourite tracks, talking to Mark Cleeter over there, by Led Zeppelin, of course. And Andy Johns produced that and actually recorded it, you know, with two mics, that drum sound, that famous drum sound, which was done with that, which is, you know, absolutely incredible. But done with that very console, with a very truck, but in a different place.
Well, they said they attributed the sounds to maybe had different textural sounds, like because of the wooden floors and the high ceilings. Maybe that had something to add to the ambience.
We're in Highgrove.
Stargroves, darling. Star.
Star, darling, yes. Yeah, well, whatever it is, it fucking works, and it sounded great, you know, really kicked
it. So what this guy, Jimmy Miller, what a guy.
Mm.
What a guy. I'd love to have met him.
Yeah.
I feel quite inspired hearing stories of good people who just really bring people together and do something, you know, get things done.
Mm.
You know, and they were in chaos at the end of the 60s. And he got them there and he got them together and he worked on 6 albums. Well, 6 years.
Mm.
Great.
Mm.
Good man. As well as working with other people. So he's not just going, no, I'm just like with the Stones. You know, he worked with other people. It was great. So he widened his influences and he worked with loads of other people after too. So it's great.
He did a couple of Motorhead albums. He did Screaming Gallica, didn't he? Primal Scream and stuff, which is incredible, before he passed away, sadly.
Yeah. So I just think, what the one thing that I've realised, though, if we're rounding this up, is that one thing that really struck me when I was reading some of the interviews that they were talking about him was that nobody knows his name. He's nameless and faceless.
Mm.
And it's like he's done so much great work, but he's one of these people that have slipped through the cracks. You just don't know about him.
Yeah.
And we're musicians, and we didn't know. I mean,
it's embarrassing, actually.
Yes.
I feel embarrassed not knowing how influential he was, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, all this time, you know, being working in the business, you know.
But isn't it better late than never? And sometimes I'm just grateful that I know it now. Because I never gauge myself on the amount of knowledge I have, because I think you should always be like a child and always open to learn, because we'll keep learning every day.
Exactly.
While we can.
But I'll tell you one thing,
yeah.
Is that every time I hear these tracks, every time I hear these producers, and, you know, I think this is number 6 in the producer series now, or 5, 6, I think, people record all together, and that is what we do. And that is the most important. I think it really, really works. Tight band, all recording together. That's the way to do it.
It's like music family. We're finding out more about our music family, aren't we, really?
Absolutely.
And it's good, because then you don't feel like you're sort of lonesome.
Are going, you lonesome?
You know, we do it this way. Yeah. And it's like, no, should we just like, just do the chorus, and then we'll play then we'll stop, and then we'll edit that bit, and then we'll fix it, and then we'll go on to the first verse, shall we?
And then we'll do half the verse and see if we can manage that.
It's like, no, you know what? We want to play songs. We like to record songs. Do you know what? We're just trying to capture music because we love music.
Exactly.
And give it back its mojo and make it feel real again.
Exactly.
That's it.
If there's one thing about Jimmy Miller, and you say one thing about him, mojo is the word. He had that mojo. He created that in the studio, and he got the very best out of the Rolling Stones, which I think was a difficult thing to do. And he got the very best out of every band that what we've heard tonight. It sounded amazing, didn't it?
Yeah. So his name's Jimmy Miller, and he was a top guy, and he absolutely
rocked our world.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Jimmy.
Yeah.
And
cheers,
so there we are. That's the end of this particular show. I think next we're going to be doing Andy Johns.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm really interested about Andy as well, because we've done Glyn.
Yeah.
Jimmy.
Yeah, and everyone
Andy
Johns. Nobody knows about Andy Johns, of course, but he actually did all the Zeppelin albums. Glenn only did one, Led Zeppelin 1.
Yeah.
Andy did all the rest and many other things, as we will hear next time.
Yes.
Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm Simon Campbell.
Yes, you are.
And you, the very man.
Yeah, thank you so much, and catch you later.
Yeah, cheers.